Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Well, Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid said today, the world is waiting to see what we're going to do next. A bipartisan group of 27 Senate moderates is back working today to trim as much as $100 billion from the $920 billion stimulus package. Reid says he's optimistic his colleagues will pass the bill by the end of today. As if on cue, job loss numbers released today once again outpaced predictions. Almost 600,000 jobs lost in January. That's the most since the end of 1974, underscoring the need for some action. Robert Guest is Washington correspondent for The Economist magazine. And Robert, you know, Harry Reid says the world is waiting to see what we're going to do next. Is that some hyperbole? What is the sense of the world watching?
It's not hyperbole at all. The world is watching. It's very important for people to know. America is the biggest country and the biggest economy in the world. Are they going to pass a big stimulus bill? Are they going to try and inject a little bit of fizz into the economy to try and reduce the length and the depth of the recession that we're facing? So, yes, it's very important.
You say maybe the most important issue facing the U.S. and maybe the world.
I would say certainly today it is, yes. Yeah.
Well, word yesterday was that the bill would pass last night. Here we are today. What went wrong?
Well, this is the Senate. It's not at all unusual for things not to pass quickly. And remember, we're talking of something that's very nearly $1 trillion, and there's 100 people there arguing over what's going to go into that. Whose projects are going to get funded, how much of it is going to be tax cuts, how much of it is going to be spent quickly. This is not the sort of thing that you would expect agreement to come quickly, so I'm not at all surprised that it's been delayed.
You know, we heard yesterday about a lot of the spending that was being cut, resodding the lawn in Washington. But is there any sense today of what's being cut?
Well, it's very hard to say. There's stuff that people are, there's a group of moderates in the middle, a combination of fiscally conservative Democrats and Republicans, and they're talking about cutting, $40 billion here for state education departments and $10 billion there for, energy and environmental cleanup stuff and $7 billion for space exploration. But, none of this has actually been agreed that they're going to cut it yet, and the price tag of the bill seems to keep swelling. I mean, it's more than $900 billion now, having been only, with very big inverted commas around them, $800 billion when it came out of the House. And we don't know what the final size of it's going to be, but there's a lot of concern that, on the one hand, you want it to be big and quick to give a jolt to the economy, but on the other hand, you're going to have to pay this money back sometime. And although the U.S. government can borrow at very low interest rates at the moment because everybody's panicking and putting their money into Treasury bills, we don't know that that's going to be true in, say, a year's time. You have to repay your debts.
Well, whatever happens in the Senate, this bill has to be reconciled with the House bill. President Obama is hoping that that happens next week. We've got a President's Day holiday coming up. It seems as if the rhetoric has gotten sharper. Republican Senator Mitch McConnell of Kentucky saying today that the GOP is ready to support a stimulus bill, but not an aimless spending spree that masquerades as a stimulus. Last night, President Obama, speaking at an event, said, you get this argument from the Republicans that this is not a stimulus bill, it's a spending bill. Well, what do you think a stimulus bill is? Is there a sense, though, that at the end of the day, it's going to be the Democrats who are going to have to give up more of the spending?
They've already allowed for a great deal of the bill to be in the form of tax cuts. I think the question of whether it's stimulus or not, the key issue there is how quickly is the money going to be spent? And I think most of the money in this bill is going to be spent fairly quickly, and that has a stimulatory effect. But there's a second issue, which is the money going to be well spent? Are you going to get something at the end of it that was worth, mortgaging your children's future for? And that's something that, a lot of people will disagree about, whether, this particular tranche of education funding in Kentucky is better spent than, an environmental cleanup stuff in Arizona. And you have a lot of sectional interest there, people saying they really want the money spent in their own area.
So, well, in the meantime, we want to ask you about another threat that your magazine is warning of, and this is the return of economic nationalism, with countries around the world rushing to erect trade barriers. You include the U.S. Congress in this. Tell us how you see this unfolding because of this debate over stimulus. What's going on?
Well, some people, some very irresponsible people in Congress, have put into the bill what we call Buy America provisions. So with the idea that if people are spending federal money or state money, that they should try to spend it on American suppliers. And that's the kind of thing that's very popular because it sounds patriotic, and it's completely disastrous. What you're basically saying is that the American government will be giving its approval to the idea that you discriminate against foreign stuff. And the consequence of that is that other countries will do the same in return because, you know, they'll retaliate. And that was what that was one of the main things that turned the stock market crash of 1929 into the Great Depression. Once you start choking off world trade, the economy goes into a death spiral. So it's terrifying. And we've had, you know, some good stuff that, you know, Obama has said he doesn't want this to happen.
Well, he spoke
and
against
there was a compromise saying that, you know, they would try to do any Buy America stuff in a way that didn't break international trade rules. But that's not nearly good enough. That's saying we're still going to be protectionist, but we're just going to do the things that our lawyers tell us we can get away with. That won't do. That's still going to give other people the opportunity to retaliate, and it's potentially disastrous.
Well, how would you or others, how have you heard anyone suggest that this stimulus package and President Obama can recognize the issues that you speak of? And as you said, Congress did water down this requirement of Buy America and said, yeah, let's just see some way to do it without violating trade agreements. How can there be some message sent to Americans that, you know, local economies, local products will somehow be given the boost that a lot of people think they desperately need?
Well, if you've got a bunch of money, say you decide that you want to have these Buy America provisions, you want to give preference to stuff depending on where it comes from. You think, well, hey, we're going to protect American steel, and that will save jobs in the steel industry. But what actually happens is you protect a few jobs in the steel industry, and then you stuff all the companies that use steel, like car companies. Now, there was a study done recently by the Peterson Institute that reckoned that, for example, the Buy America provisions in the Senate package would save or create 9,000 American jobs and destroy 65,000. So it's a massive loss even before the tit-for-tat escalation of trade war begins. So it's just a terrible idea. I mean, it's something that there's really no disagreement about among economists. It's not well understood by the public. The only person who can sell this idea, and we know he understands it because I took that steel example from Obama's own book, is Barack Obama. He's the most popular man in the world, probably, certainly among politicians. He needs to stand up and say, we will not have protectionism. If there is this stuff in the bill, I will veto it and make sure that it comes out. He will also then be able to cool. This is an international trend towards more protectionism at the moment because people are panicking. And he's really the only person who's got the bully pulpit who can stop it.
Robert Guest, Washington correspondent for The Economist magazine. Robert, thanks so much for weighing in today.
Thank you.
Well, which countries are most affected by the wounded American economy and the debate over how to fix it? Well, maybe several in Africa, because let's be frank, no one here in the States is paying much attention anymore. Civilians are still being killed by the Janjaweed in Darfur. Cholera has ravaged Zimbabwe. There's conflict in Kenya and Somalia. Our next guest is following these stories. Gwen Tompkins is East Africa correspondent for National Public Radio. She covers countries from the Horn to the heart of Africa from her base in Nairobi, Kenya. And today we want to have a reporter's notebook with Gwen. Open it up. Tell us the stories that maybe don't get on the air. Gwen is visiting Boston today and joins us in the studio. Can you give us the big picture, though, in Africa, a unifying theme to what's going on?
Well, that's a tough question. I mean, you know, Africa is more than 50 countries, you know what I mean, on the continent, and, you know, with all manner of divergent motivations and histories. But in my corner of the continent in East Africa, I mean, right now people are really searching for stability and hoping to sort of plunder the fruits of stability, political stability, economic stability in the region. You know, it has been a difficult time. This is covering East Africa is very much like working in a diner. I mean, the pots are simmering pretty much on every part of the stove.
Every
you
burner.
Know, indeed. And so I, you know, the more that I stay there and report from there, the more I realize how distinct every country is and how distinct, their burdens and their joys really are.
Well, let's take a look at them. Let's start with Kenya, where you live. We're a year after that terrible violence that followed the 2007 presidential elections there. Listeners remember followers of the incumbent, Mwai Kibaki, who won over Raila Odinga. There was a recount. Eventually, the two men agreed to share power, but it sparked all these old ethnic tensions between tribes. In fact, the Kikuyu and the Luo, and the Obama's grandmother is from the Luo tribe. So, you know, people were sort of tuning into this story. But what's it like in Kenya today?
Well, it is for the time being. I mean, things are tense but calm, in the sense that you're right. Ethnic tensions are longstanding in Kenya, and at election time, they really seem to boil over. This violence that we saw last year was terrible, but it wasn't unprecedented. Presidential elections have always, or not always, but have for many years now been real cataclysms, really, of ethnic conflict that's been stoked by many of the politicians who stand to gain from it.
Well, you filed a report recently when you said Kenyans are not optimistic. Tell me a personal account, someone you've met.
Well, I just wanted to give a little background in what you were talking about earlier with Mwai Kibaki, who is the incumbent and who's the current president of Kenya. He is Kikuyu. He's from the Kikuyu tribe, which is the largest, the most economically muscular tribe in Kenya. Raila Odinga, who is currently the prime minister, is from the Luo tribe. And as you said very correctly, Mr. Obama's family is a Luo also. Now, after the violence, there was a tremendous number of internally displaced people, in Kenya. And many of them have gone off the official books, but they're still internally displaced. Mm-hmm. So in some areas, for instance, many of the people who lost their homes, lost their land, they pulled whatever money they got from the government, to start new lives, and it wasn't very much money, and they bought land. So right now, outside of Nairobi, not very far outside of Nairobi, and all through the Rift Valley, you see these areas that have been purchased by groups of internally displaced people, Kikuyu farmers, for instance, or Kikuyu merchants. And they're living in little tents, essentially, that they got from the UN, And they are essentially trying to start their lives again only with land. They have no other resources.
Well, we want to hear a little more of their story. We're talking to Gwen Tompkins, East Africa correspondent for NPR. What has been the impact of having, a president in America who's a descendant of a tribe in Kenya, but also a look at Congo, Somalia, terrible stories. Is there any good news out of East Africa? We're going to ask Gwen Tompkins when we come back. Welcome back to our conversation with Gwen Tompkins, NPR's East Africa correspondent. We're just checking in on a region that really has been moved off the headlines because of all the economic news here in the U.S., but the stories have still been going on. And Gwen, we were talking about Kenya, where you're living now, and the fact that President Obama, the new president of America, is a descendant of a tribe there. Everyone knows that. But is there a certain expectation among Kenyans that something might happen positively for them because of that, because Obama is president?
Absolutely. Absolutely. In many African cultures, people have very strong expectations within a family or within a clan of a family member or a clan member who does well. And there is no family member who has done better than Barack Obama has done. And so there are plenty of expectations among people who are from his ancestral homeland. There, I mean, I've talked to people who are hoping that Mr. Obama will help them open a barbershop, for instance. Hmm. Or I've talked to people who are hoping that Mr. Obama will help build schools and hospitals and pave roads, you know what I mean, in Western Kenya. And many, on the face of it, many people appear to have very unrealistic expectations about what's going to happen. You know, the power of an American president, for instance, to set up electricity in your neighborhood in Kenya. But at the same time, I came to realize that maybe they're savvier than I thought, because the truth of the matter is the Kenyan government, to a large degree, has been emboldened or maybe even shamed into providing better services for people in Western Kenya, in large part because they knew that the international media would be descending upon this region and would notice that, that a lot of these areas need, very fundamental infrastructure.
Well, that might be the one note of optimism in the region you cover, because as we look at the countries, there's been a cholera epidemic in Zimbabwe. We spoke on Here and Now to the head of an Italian charitable hospital there. They have to forage for food for their patients in Zimbabwe. You've been reporting on Somalia, which hasn't had a functioning government since 1991. We know radical Islamist fighters recently overran the seat of government there and declared Sharia law. What's the situation in Somalia?
Well, I mean, the situation is unfolding, I suppose. The government now is outside of the country of Somalia geographically. They've been in Djibouti, neighboring Djibouti, and trying to sort themselves out.
They'd have to fight their way back in.
They might. They certainly might. There are sort of Islamist extremists who have taken over the parliament building in Baidoa, the town of Baidoa, and who have taken over much of the country. Now, they've not succeeded in taking over Mogadishu, which is of course the big pearl of Somalia, but they're hoping. Now, it's not all bad news, I have to say. I mean, it's not all bad news from the region. It's not all bad news from the continent. It's not even all bad news from Somalia. There is an abiding hope among many of the people there that, that they will sort themselves out. And given the fact that the government has expanded of late, the parliament, which is out of the country, but they have expanded of late to include a lot more representatives from different sectors of Somali society, so that the government now is, speaks for more people in Somali society. There really is an expectation that the government will be able to do some good for the people, even in its present state outside the country.
Well, we just have a couple minutes, Gwen, but we have to ask Sudan, Darfur, neighboring Libya's president Muammar Gaddafi is the new chair of the African Union. He says he's going to end the crisis in Darfur, but we understand that's not going very well.
Well, I mean, Mr. Gaddafi has always shown a very strong interest in becoming a mediator, a peace broker in the region. And he has actually, not so long ago, he actually tried to host a conference that would bring many of the rebels, the Darfur rebels, together in Libya, with UN representatives as well, to sort of mediate, a peace deal with the government. So he knows a lot more than most people give him credit for. Mr. Gaddafi.
Oh, I just meant that the problem may be too big even for that optimism,
Well, Darfur is a thorny issue, definitely. But it is not as dire in many instances as I think the media plays it to be. When I go to Darfur, for instance, I'm always shocked at how well people seem to be doing. Yes, there is violence. Yes, there are instances, and particularly recently, where the government has been bombing particular areas outside El Fasher and other parts of areas of the region. But at the same time, the international humanitarian aid community has done a terrific job, taking care of many of the people who've been displaced by the violence. There are other parts of East Africa where the people are doing far worse, that don't get the coverage, for instance, northern Uganda, for instance, northern Congo, eastern Congo as well.
So just when we thought you were going to leave us on a good note, we should open our minds to being told about other issues, and we will when Gwen Tompkins gets back to work as East Africa correspondent for NPR. Gwen, thanks for spending some time with us, and we always look forward to your reporting.
Thank you so very much.
Quick note now, yesterday we spoke with a fertility specialist and a bioethicist about the questions raised by the recent birth of octuplets to a mother who already has six children through in vitro fertilization. Well, one of the questions, should a doctor have said no to Nadia Suleiman, who is single, unemployed, and living with her parents? Today, Suleiman spoke for the first time with Today Show's Ann Curry.
Did you use the same fertility specialist for all of your pregnancies?
Yes.
So your fertility specialist knew that you already had six children?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
How many embryos were you implanted with?
The same as with the others, six.
Did he explain to you the risks of a multiple birth?
All of them. Absolutely, with all of them.
You didn't want just one or two embryos?
Of course not. I wanted them all transferred. Those are my children. And that's what was available, and I used them. So I took a risk. It's a gamble. It always is.
So the six embryos Suleiman had transferred produced eight children. As we heard yesterday, multiple transfers of embryos can also impose a risk to the entire pregnancy. And as she just said, she took that risk. And she said she did so because all her life she wanted to be a mother.
Sometimes we have that dream and that passion and we take risks. And I did. And it turned out perfectly.
Suleiman also said she hopes to support the children once she finishes her master's degree. She also says she has never been on welfare. Public records indicate that Suleiman has collected more than $165,000 in disability payments after a work injury she contracted while employed at a state mental hospital in California. So we have heard from the mother of the octuplets. Back in a minute, here and now. What would you do if your child had a rare disease and no doctor could diagnose it? When Hugh Renoff's daughter, Beatrice, was born with an unidentifiable genetic disorder, he decided to look for the answer himself by digging into his daughter's DNA. Renoff is uniquely qualified to do this. He's a practicing pediatrician in San Francisco, but he's also one of only about 120 clinical geneticists in the country. His story was featured in Wired magazine. It's fascinating, and he joins us in the studio to tell it. Welcome.
Thank you.
And Beatrice, your daughter, she's cute as a button.
She is.
She's pictured in the magazine. She's five now. Let's go back and start when she was born. You knew something was just off.
I was in the operating room when my daughter was born. She was born by C-section. And as soon as she came out, she was a bit floppy, which I thought was just part of the struggle of being plucked out of the womb. Mm-hmm. But she also had some other things. Her feet were quite large and narrow, which suggested to me in a fleeting thought that she had something that I'd seen before called Marfan syndrome. I didn't give it too much thought, but when the pediatrician came back, she pointed out a port wine stain that was on her face and her scalp and contracted fingers and suggested that something might be going on.
But she didn't have Marfan syndrome because she was tested for that, and there were other thoughts about what she might have, but nobody could ever figure it out. How is she now at five?
Beatrice is essentially, from a distance, a completely normal little girl, and she doesn't have any conception that there's anything significantly wrong. She knows her fingers are a little contracted, and she knows she doesn't have quite the muscular strength that her peers do. But that does not deter her at all.
And yet you know that her muscles are frail and that her heart might be in danger. Why?
Well, her muscles are underdeveloped. I think what she has is fine, but she just doesn't have very much muscle, and it's really striking. And she has difficulty getting up and down stairs and those sort of things because of that. Her heart may be at risk, but I get an echocardiogram every year to make sure, and so
right.
far everything's been okay.
Well, so you're keeping an eye on Beatrice, but also you are examining her DNA. Now, this is fascinating to people. We want to point out, first of all, this is not like there was a recent story in the New York Times about doctors who were making their own children research subjects because they couldn't find enough subjects. For instance, one doctor was studying her own children to see the effect of media. This isn't that. This is a father whose daughter already has a problem and you're trying to find out what it is. It gets very detailed and complicated, but just take a second and say what you are doing with your genetic studies.
Sure. In some ways, it's very basic. DNA is something you can get from white blood cells, so I took Beatrice down to the phlebotomist and got them to draw some blood along with some other routine tests. And I took that blood to a friend of mine's lab at Stanford and extracted the DNA, which took about an hour. It doesn't take very long. And then I went online and I ordered all of the DNA primers that are necessary to amplify specific genes, the three genes that I thought were interesting. Then I actually sent them out to a lab, and for $3.50 per reaction, they'll send you back a little file. And so at night I would get these files back, and I would just compare Beatrice's sequence with the standard genome sequence and look for differences. After about 20,000 different base pairs, I found one that was not present in the database, and so I focused on that one. Eventually, I found that actually she got that single base from me, although it is unique in the human genome.
But it isn't the cause of the disease.
But it's probably not the cause.
Yeah.
So then I took another approach, which was much grander. It took me another year to get this off the ground, which was to sequence all of her RNA, which is called the transcriptome, out of white blood cells, and of course, looking for changes there. And I did the same for my wife and myself. And that is a billion base pairs of DNA. Much more work to sort through, and that's where I am today, and working with MIT and some people out west.
Amazing amount of work. Your home office has turned into sort of a lab. You've got papers and files spread everywhere. You've got this high-tech equipment you were speaking of. You spend all this time on this. I can imagine some people with children with a problem saying, wow, how lucky he is that his background is in genetics, that he can do this. But I know even some of your close friends in genetics are saying to you, you've gone too far, you know.
What I would say is that I don't think there's any parent that can truly stand by and just watch the whole thing parade down in front of them. I think every parent does what they can do, and this is something I can do. There's a good chance that it is in her DNA. The question is, you know, how long does it take to find it?
Well, and then there's the other disturbing thought, which is you find the one thing that's different, and there's no cure for it.
That's, in some ways, a completely separate issue. I think you manage the case, if you will, using all the modern tools of medicine and the echocardiogram and those sort of things. But finding the change is, yes, it doesn't necessarily lead to a change in the management plan or a cure, but it's the beginning of trying to define this particular syndrome. And there always has to be a first case of everything. And Beatrice will probably be the first example of whatever that is.
Well, and if there are other Beatrices, you stand a good chance of finding out because you started a website, mydaughtersdna.org,
yes,
in which other parents who have inexplicable problems in their children can also weigh in. And through that website, I think there's at least one man, a Bulgarian man, who was able to get a diagnosis for his daughter because someone else saw, you know, something in his description that they knew what it was.
And in that particular case, it's especially gratifying because there was a treatment. There are probably 3,000 genetic diseases, and nobody can know them all. And it's entirely conceivable there's nobody in Bulgaria that's ever seen a case that was similar to what that father described in his daughter.
Do you think there's any chance that someone will hear about Beatrice, step forward and say, I know what this is?
I don't think someone will step forward and say, I've seen 10 Beatrices or something like that. I do think it's very possible, though, that there are people who study those pathways and perhaps have made a mouse that has some similarity because they knocked out a particular gene. I think it will eventually come to light, quite honestly. I'm an optimist. I wouldn't do this if I was a pessimist. I have to say, it is the journey. The journey is, I'm not so much focused on the end. I was for a while because I had a very specific hypothesis. I looked at those three genes. I really thought I would find something there, and I didn't. But you might say I'm still in at the phase where we're casting the net, and we're just pulling that net in, and it's full of fish. And so there's, you know, I'm looking for one particular species, you might say, and so it's a lot of sorting through. So it's harvest time.
What a gift! Does she know? Does she have any idea what Dad's doing?
But she said to me the other day, I said, it's time to get a flu vaccine, and she said, I don't want to have any shots, but, you know, if it's for DNA, that's fine. But I think beyond that, she knows I go and look at her DNA. But otherwise, she's oblivious to that, and as I said, she doesn't consider herself any different than any other kid, really.
That's Hugh Rienhoff talking about his daughter Beatrice. He's trying to figure out what her genetic disorder is by researching her DNA. Hugh, thanks so much for speaking with us, and best of luck to you.
My pleasure.
In another chapter of what's being called one of the largest foodborne illness outbreaks ever, salmonella-contaminated peanut products may have found their way into some school lunch programs by way of the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Tainted peanut paste made by the Peanut Corporation of America has now sickened nearly 600 people in 43 states, killing at least 8. 1,300 food products have been recalled. And remember, peanut butter in jars and Girl Scout cookies have not been affected. The contamination has been traced to the PCA's factory in Georgia, and last week, schools in California, Minnesota, and Idaho were notified that they may have received tainted products in their free lunch programs. Apparently, the USDA sent inspectors to the Georgia plant several times over the years, but they weren't food inspectors. They just checked to see if the proper equipment was installed. Bill Marler is attorney representing a couple dozen victims of the contaminated food in a lawsuit against the Peanut Corporation of America. And Bill, I also understand you're now suing the Kellogg Corporation.
We are. It's pretty evident that Kellogg was quite involved in having their own inspectors inspecting the plants. We got a hold of those inspection reports in the last few days, and they are dramatically different than what the FDA and even Georgia State agricultural officials were finding. PCA got high, superb rankings by the third-party auditors hired by Kellogg.
Well, Kellogg does say it's going to review how it qualifies suppliers after its food safety auditor, its third-party auditor, gave the peanut company superior ratings. So what do you say to that? I mean, Kellogg admits that there may have been a problem with that auditor.
Well, it's a little bit, you know, trying to catch the horse after it's out of the barn. I mean, companies that put their name on products that consumers buy, when they frankly, you know, never visit a facility, you know, I appreciate that Kellogg is sorry now that it's poisoned hundreds of people with its product, but it's the one that contracted with PCA to provide that product, which now has sickened nearly 600 and killed 8 people.
Well, you're going to be testifying before Congress next week. Given now that we're learning that the government itself, the USDA, bought products from the Peanut Corporation of America and yesterday suspended its contract with the company, what are you going to say to Congress?
Well, this will be the third time in 3 years that I've been in front of this committee. In fact, I'm thinking actually of just reading my testimony from the first time because, frankly, nothing's changed. You know, we need more resources with the CDC so we can actually figure out outbreaks before they become national disasters, to fund FDA at a level that allows them to inspect plants more than once every 5 years, and to, you know, enforce testing protocols in manufacturing companies and making those testing protocols mandatorily online or certainly mandatorily disclosable. So your question with respect to the USDA canceling the contract and actually throwing the president of PCA off the Peanut Standards Board as well, one of the things that's clear is that not only did schools get it, but the military got it. It's in some forms of MREs, as well as disaster relief packets have been found to have this peanut butter in it. The fact that the USDA is now canceling contracts in a company that is likely bankrupt today or certainly by Monday is a little bit, you know, too little too late, but Secretary Vilsack sending a pretty strong message.
Well, but doesn't this all go back to the fact that the FDA has been understaffed, underfunded? They don't now possibly have the number of personnel it would take to go inspect companies like the Peanut Corporation of America. Don't there have to be a lot more people on the payroll?
I absolutely agree with you. And frankly, that's why we've seen a proliferation of these third-party auditors hired by companies that are responsible only to those companies. I can't tell you how many positive third-party audits I've seen in situations where several months later an outbreak has happened in a plant that sickened and killed people.
Bill Marler is a partner in the law firm Marler Clark in Seattle, Washington. He represents 25 victims of the recent salmonella outbreak due to peanut paste. And we also should mention you're a candidate for Assistant Secretary of Agriculture, and we just got a taste of what you might do if you get that post. Bill, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much.
Welcome back. We keep hearing that the record industry is on the verge of a collapse, but as Here and Now's jazz aficionado James Isaacs tells us, there's hope, at least in the area of jazz, where two labels are celebrating major anniversaries and one's being revived. James Isaacs joins us in the studio with more. What are we listening to and why?
Robin, we were listening to Meade Lux Lewis. The track is called The Blues, Part 1, and I've chosen it to inaugurate today's festivities because on January 6th, 1939, 70 years ago in New York, Albert Ammons and his fellow keyboard giant Meade Lux Lewis recorded a series of performances, separately and together. These turned out to be the very first sides for what would become the standard bearer of independent jazz labels, Blue Note Records, a great label.
Who founded Blue Note?
A guy named Alfred Lion, a most remarkable man from Berlin in Germany. Lion arrived in New York in 1938. Shortly thereafter, Lion was joined by his good friend Francis Wolff. The two had known one another when they were teenage jazz hounds in Germany back in the 1920s. And once the partnership was formed in New York, Lion produced the records and Wolff shot most of the cover photos. Right from the beginning, they created what would become a brand.
And, you know, people might say, oh, yeah, Blue Note, I know it. But really, what is it? What's that brand?
Well, the brand really depends on one word. And Alfred Lion said many times, the music must swing. Now, lots of jazz labels pride themselves on signing artists who swing, or swing for that matter. But one thing that set Blue Note apart is that they sought out nothing but the finest black improvisers, from mainstream swing to bebop to hard bop to soul jazz, and in the 1960s, the avant-garde. For example, when no one else in the music business would touch Thelonious Monk's personal and musical eccentricities with a barge pole, as they say in Britain, Blue Note in 1947 gave him a shot. Monk stayed with Blue Note until 1952, and here he is leading a 1951 quintet featuring Milt Jackson on vibes and Sahib Shahab on alto saxophone. This is one of Monk's most brilliantly self-contained originals, Crisscross.
James, you know, why has Blue Note endured?
For one thing, the label usually provided paid rehearsal time for the players as they got ready to make their albums, and this preparation was apparent in the finished product. Of course, there was also the crossover success of an artist named Nora Jones, and at this point she really needs no introduction.
I left you by the house of fun. I don't know why I didn't. Don't know why I didn't come.
Where well, Blue Note is doing some special things to commemorate the 70th anniversary. What
they are? Well, there'll be tributes and festivals around the world. There's a Blue Note biography by Ashley Kahn, who has written about Miles Davis's album Kind of Blue, among other projects. And there's a photography book of Francis Wolff's cover images from the early Blue Note years. And last but not least, there's an all-star group. They're called the Blue Note 7, and they've made a first-rate album called Mosaic, a celebration of Blue Note records. The septet renders classic compositions by such Blue Note legends as Monk and Herbie Hancock and Joe Henderson. And this is a taste of a new version of Joe Henderson's probing Inner Urge with Peter Washington's bass, Peter Bernstein's guitar, and Bill Charlap's piano carrying the melody before the ensemble picks it up. Inner Urge.
Inner Urge from the CD Mosaic, a celebration of Blue Note records. As always, we're going to have a list of James' music at our website, here-now.org. James, you have another anniversary to tell us about.
This is true, Robin. ECM Records is 40 years old this year, and the label is, in its own way, as distinctive as Blue Note.
Why is that?
Manfred Eicher, the label's founder, is every bit the aesthete that Alfred Lion and Francis Wolff were. He also had a strong sense of forging a personal sound and developing a catalog that would endure. If Blue Note was the sound of urban New York, ECM captured, I guess you could say, Northern Europe's wintry skies and fields of snow, with touches of world music adding to the mix. Here's a bit of the Norwegian saxophonist and composer Jan Garbarek. This is the title piece from his disc, Visible World. But ECM is more than love among the runes.
R-U-N-E-S.
True. Individualistic American musicians such as Pat Metheny, Charles Lloyd, Paul and Carla Bley, and the virtuoso pianist Keith Jarrett have expanded their audiences globally through ECM.
Well, and listeners might remember we spoke with Keith last year about his work with bassist Gary Peacock and drummer Jack DeJohnette. Let's listen to a little more of their music.
Keith Jarrett's acclaimed group known as the Standards Trio, that's Charlie Parker's tune called Scrapple from the Apple, and it's taken from Jarrett's new ECM album, Yesterdays.
James, you want to conclude with a label that's being reborn.
I do, Robin. It's Xanadu Records, which was founded in 1975 by a guy named Don Schlitten. Schlitten was a kind of lion and wolf in one. Like Alfred Lion, he produced the albums. Like Francis Wolfe, he also took the cover photos. Schlitten was first and foremost a bebopper, and his artist roster reflected that. But this is a new Xanadu, and as far as I know, Schlitten is not involved in it.
So who is?
It's a company called The Orchard, and I would say they're a multimedia outfit. In addition to the new album that we'll be talking about presently, they're reissuing some stuff from the 70s.
Well, we also know the guitarist Peter Bernstein. You just mentioned he played with the Blue Note 7. He's also now involved in Xanadu.
He is, Robin. And, you know, the thing is, guitar players don't often set themselves the task of recording 12 Thelonious Monk originals. That's exactly what Peter Bernstein has undertaken on this new album called, you know, it's a very surprising title here, Monk. Peter Bernstein is backed only by bass and drums, so the focus is very much on him. Even at this late date, Monk's tunes remain, I would say, notoriously knotty. But listen to the way that Bernstein's trio navigates the labyrinth with ease on Monk's Well You Needn't.
Here now is jazz aficionado James Isaacs bringing us the news of two anniversaries and a revival. As always, we'll have more information at our website, here-now.org. James, as always, thanks so much.
Robin, as always, my pleasure.